Our gospel reading today comes from the gospel according to John, chapter 21, verses 15 through 19. Listen closely to the word of the Lord. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my lambs." A second time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And Peter felt hurt because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep. Very truly, I tell you, when you were younger, you used to fasten your own belt and go wherever you wished. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands, and someone else will fasten a belt around you and take you where you do not wish to go." He said this to indicate the kind of death by which he would glorify God. And after this, he said to him, "Follow me." There ends the reading. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. There is a comedy troupe in New York City called Improv Everywhere. And their mission, according to their website, is to create unexpected performances in public places with the aim to surprise and delight random strangers through positive pranks. And they describe positive pranks, by the way, as a prank that creates laughter and wonder and delight, not pain or embarrassment or humiliation. For example, they flooded a Best Buy store in Manhattan with hundreds of men and women dressed in blue polo shirts just to see how people would react. Or they had 100 people freeze in place in Grand Central Station for exactly 4 minutes before continuing on their way. And one of my favorite pranks is a more modest one they call the Mobius Strip. The Mobius strip is a mathematical concept, a single-sided strip of paper with a twist in the middle that connects back on itself in a loop. And there are many people in this congregation who understand it better than me, so don't get too worried about it, but just know that it loops, but it also twists, and that mathematically it does things that seem to be impossible. That is the best I can explain it. I am sorry, I am a minister. Anyway, for the prank, Improv Everywhere meticulously rehearsed a sequence of events involving 8 actors, all of whom located themselves inside of an unsuspecting Starbucks in Astor Place. 2 actors played a husband and a wife who get into an argument in line because the husband has started smoking again. "Wait a minute, is that a cigarette?" she says indignantly. "Are you kidding me?" And the husband responds, and their argument escalates until finally the wife leaves the store upset, and her husband follows after. And then another actor takes a phone call and has to move closer to the window to get better reception, and another spills a cup of coffee on the floor, apologetically wiping it up with a napkin. And then finally, the absurd conclusion, a man walks through the store with a boombox that is playing "Shiny Happy People" by R.E.M., and he goes in one door and out the other without saying a word. But the instant the man with the boombox goes out the door, the husband and the wife re-enter the store exactly as they did before, and they are holding hands, and they seem happy, and they get into the line before the wife says, "Wait a minute, is that a cigarette? Are you kidding me?" And the cycle starts all over again. And it's not really until the third circuit of the actions that the regular old paying customers, the unwitting audience of this performance, start to actually pay attention to what is happening. And they start to nudge each other. "Do you see this?" they say. They start to predict what will happen next. "Now the man will spill his coffee. Wait for it." And he does, and it gives the people a rush of adrenaline to be able to predict the future. And when the man with the boombox comes back through a third time, the whole store bursts into laughter because who would do this? And they repeat the cycle for 1 hour or about 12 times without ever breaking character. And many of the people in the store are repeating the lines along with them. And then the 12th time the man with the boombox leaves the store, nothing else happens because the show is over and the people are just left with "Shiny Happy People" echoing in their heads waiting for the next extraordinary thing that might happen to them. And that whole thing, by the way, is captured on video, and you can watch it, and many other pranks at improveverywhere.com. And we are in our own sort of Mobius loop, you know, in this sermon series. We've reached the fifth week now of this series exploring the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, pairing them with passages from Scripture. And you can see all 12 steps listed in the back of your bulletin. But today we are tackling step 9, making direct amends to people we have harmed, except when doing so would harm them. And then we move on to step 10, continuing to take a personal inventory of when we are wrong and then promptly admitting it. The transition from step 9 to step 10 moves us into a new phase of the 12 steps. Steps 10, 11, and 12 are considered the maintenance steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, meaning that if all is going well in your recovery, you can cultivate them in repetition as a lifestyle of recovery. The initial 12 steps involve dramatic foundational shifts in perspective, owning the reality of your addiction, acknowledging the need for a higher power. Those steps can take a very long time to move through. And then having done the hard work of acknowledging all your flaws and wrongdoing, having done the hard work of sharing your shortcomings with other people, and then making amends to the best of your ability, you might be a little bit dismayed to discover that step 10 returns once again to the personal inventory. More self-examination? Really? And there are those outside of AA and occasionally inside of AA who argue that this model is flawed because it forces people to own the identity of addict. You're constantly repeating it as your identity. Hello, my name is, and I am an alcoholic. Or acknowledging your powerlessness, or making amends, or as step 10 would have it, beginning your personal inventory all over again. And in addition to the perceived negativity, there is something a little bit exhausting about the grind, the cycle. The idea of the work of being in recovery is never over. And it is very true that one can get addicted to self-critique. God knows the church has made that mistake. I also think we live in a culture that always values new over old and sees repetition as inherently boring. How could you possibly just repeat those steps again and again? What could be gained from something like that? But I think we would be wise to see the repetition less as an obsession with self-analysis and more as a spiritual practice. Richard Rohr notes a similar evolution in the prayer life of Jesuit priests. We initially learned about a daily and personal examination of conscience, he writes, which certainly had some wise intent and worked for some. But I found that people with a mature conscience did this naturally anyway, and some of them way too much. Now many of the Jesuits recommend instead an examination of consciousness, which to me seems much more fruitful. And by examination of consciousness, Rohr means adopting spiritual practices like prayer, contemplation, confession, and even silence that allow us to escape our howling brains and pay attention to what God is doing on the deeper level of our existence. Like a Mobius strip, there are some forms of repetition that expand our awareness rather than reduce it. There is something to be said for learning to live inside of the rhythms and disciplines that repeat. In my own humble exploration of the recovery process, it seems to be much needed infrastructure, a corrective to the stinking thinking that will lead an alcoholic back to the drink if left to their own devices. Throughout this sermon series, Andrew and I have made the case that the wisdom of AA applies to nearly any one of us. We each struggle with addictions and compulsions and self-defeating tendencies. Alcoholism is simply a very harrowing and visible manifestation of a universal problem that the church has taken to calling sin. But each of us needs structures and rhythms that perhaps, over time, will twist us into something new. We come to church for a lot of reasons, I think it's fair to say, and I think we run the risk with all of our rituals and repetitions and liturgical calendars of looking like an endlessly repeating loop. And if this is some kind of religious Groundhog Day where the same thing happens week after week at exactly the same time with exactly the same result, one might wonder, what is the point? But our gospel reading today manages to pull the threads together, touching on step 9 and step 10, and then, with a twist of the Mobius strip, something new. Because there was a man standing on the beach, on the shore of the Sea of Tiberias in the region of Galilee. And that man had a lot of opinions, as it turns out, about what constitutes the best practices of fishing. And fishermen of all times and places are not known to appreciate unsolicited advice from strangers about fishing. And these fishermen were no exception. But they did do what he suggested, and the fish poured into the nets, straining them to the breaking point. And it was less the man's voice and more the excess of fish in the net that opened their eyes. It was as though they recognized him in the abundance. They realized it was Jesus. And while they all realized it was Jesus, only Peter found it necessary to jump out of the boat and swim the final paces to the beach, back to the man they had believed to be dead. And knowing Peter, a man who almost always acts first and reflects second, he was probably halfway up the beach, heaving and heavy with seawater, before he realized the full implication of the reunion that was about to happen. Because the last time he had been face to face with Jesus, it had been to betray him. "I don't know him," he had cried out no less than 3 times as the guards were dragging Jesus to his death. And the moment had arrived just as Jesus predicted, and Peter had failed, and now here he was, standing on the beach in front of a man he loved more than anyone, a man he could scarcely look in the eye without seeing his own failure. It's a telling moment, isn't it, that Peter loves Jesus so much that he leaps out of the boat to swim to him, only to realize that he has no idea what to say when he arrives, because he has no idea how to rebuild the bridges that he has burned. I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that most of us have a person like this in our lives, a person that we love so much and a person we can scarcely look in the eye because we've hurt them, because there is too much history, because maybe we just don't know where to start. The 12 steps address this so concisely. Step 8, make a list of persons we've harmed and become willing to make amends with them. I appreciate that finding the will to make amends is its own step. Some folks in AA will tell you that step 8 is the real work. Some people stay on that step for a very long time. Step 9 simply says, make direct amends with such people, but with 2 very wise caveats. First, whenever possible, it's not always possible. And second, when such a confession will not do further harm to others. In other words, this is not a zero-sum game. There are times when reconciliation will soothe our own egos, but actually continue to wound other people. And the 12 steps wisely says that this is not what the work is about. I'm sure I'm not the only one who feels like a little more advice is needed. Old wounds don't heal overnight, after all, and some don't heal at all. But I do appreciate the advice of step 10, however annoying. When in doubt, return to the cycle. When you don't know what else to do, lean into the loop. It wasn't until breakfast was over and they were lounging on the beach by a smoldering charcoal fire that Peter found himself inside of the conversation he had been dreading. And the fire seemed to invite comparisons to the fire pit where Peter had warmed himself before denying Jesus, but he preferred not to think about that. "Peter, son of John, do you love me more than these?" It's a weird question, and we're left to wonder about the tone of Jesus' voice. Was it playful? Was it pointed? I imagine Peter laughing a little bit defensively, preferring to interpret it playfully. "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus replied, "Feed my lambs." A strange little exchange, and all well and good, but Jesus feels the need to repeat himself. "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And I can imagine a flush of color in Peter's cheeks as the question is asked again. "Yes, Lord," he says more seriously, "you know that I love you. Then tend my sheep." The third time Jesus asks the question, there is no pretense of normal conversation anymore. Jesus is explicitly invoking Peter's 3 denials when he asks a third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And the scripture says that Peter was hurt by the third question, and he replied, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." And Jesus replies with a new response, a call. "When you were young, you used to go where you wished, but now, follow me." And the rest of the story is told in the book of Acts. Peter goes on to become a key leader, perhaps the key leader in Christ's church. Please don't mishear me. I'm not really suggesting that there is a direct correlation between the 12 steps and Jesus' reconciliation with Peter. There are obvious differences, but I do think there is some wisdom to hold up here, just some observations. Why does Jesus repeat his question? I don't think it's because he doubts Peter's answer. I don't think it's because he intends to shame him. But I think rather loop by loop, he is healing him. He is reinstating him. He is saying, I am hardly done with you yet. And in fact, if you are willing, there is so much more for us to do together. Spiritual wisdom, the kind of wisdom talked about in Paul's letter to the Corinthians, it's not just sitting there on the surface waiting for us to pick it up. You can't just absorb it like information from an article. That's a very Western way of thinking about wisdom and healing. What couldn't we learn from an online course or a good book? Instead, Paul says, we speak God's wisdom secret and hidden, which God decreed before the ages for our glory. And what no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the human heart conceived, what God has prepared for those of us who love him. And I don't think that means there's some kind of secret code or knowledge to be learned, because that's Da Vinci Code nonsense. I think rather that spiritual wisdom is learned by living into it, by trusting the process, by accepting the notion that the repetitive steps of the holy way, we will find ourselves with a twist of the Möbius strip someplace unexpected. Now, I know that some married couples, not me and Perry, of course, but other people might see a wry resemblance to their own marital conflict in that poor couple who have the exact same argument on repeat every 5 minutes for an hour. Wait a minute, is that a cigarette? Are you kidding me? It seems to be the unique burden of any long-term relationship, whether friend or family or lover, to endure the same fights, the same conversations, the same situations again and again and again. But if you were lucky, it is also surely the grace of long-term relationship to discover along the way that there can be healing and hearing and reconciliation inside of those repetitions. And sometimes it's a big dramatic change, but more often it's just growth through repetition over time. And I have to think that that's how our relationship with God works too. We show up in good faith. Sometimes, like Peter, we show up feeling wet and worthless, but we find ourselves strangely encouraged. AA is so great on this point. Keep coming back, they say cheerfully to the person who just relapsed. And they mean it because all of them heard those words at some point in their life, like a life preserver thrown out into the water. And so we show up in good faith and we work the steps and we say the words, even if we don't really believe them, and we return to the stupid personal inventory. And we summon the courage to attempt to make amends with a person that, frankly, we've always enjoyed hating. And if it were all simply a loop on repeat, just a gif, we would have good reason to despair. But if, in fact, it is a Möbius loop, if, in fact, there is a twist that makes impossible things possible, then we have reason to hope. My favorite thing about the Möbius loop video is Unspoken. It's the idea that there are these bored people in a boring Starbucks that looks like every other Starbucks in Manhattan. People who go there every day are suddenly sitting upright in their seats saying, "Are you seeing this?" People who have never looked up from their phones before are singing "Shiny, Happy People" together in a room in Manhattan. This is a low-key miracle. A good spiritual practice will not just elevate your spirit, but center you in the present moment, quiet your soul, and open your eyes enough to hear the good news that perhaps you have never been able to hear before, which is how much you were loved and how much you are forgiven, and how, yes, it is not too late for you to begin again. The testimony of folks from AA happens to match up with some of the wisest saints in the Christian tradition. And what is it that they are saying to us? What eye has seen, and what ear has heard, and what heart has possibly conceived what God is preparing for you and for me, beloved, when we gather together in love?